Oh, hey there, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Thompson.
Hey, guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Karen, how's school?
It's school. It started, and, you know, it's always disorienting to come back because in the times that I've gone during the summer to campus, it's just like empty and idyllic. And now there are just a lot of, you know, Ugg boots with short shorts and people texting while riding bicycles.
Is it hard to have to look at fresh 18-year-olds every year?
I think that it's the thing that's hardest is that I keep getting older and everyone stays the same age. And now at this point, my graduate students also are a lot younger. So
yeah, you and Matthew McConaughey. and the fact that I went directly to Karen Thompson means we have some absences in the house, which means we have some presences in the house. We have two special guests, but they're not just special guests. They are former temporary panelists. It is 7th and 8th Beatles. well, first, Alonzo Giralde, of Who Shot Ya and Knowing Things About Movies.
Hi, Guy.
Hey, how's it going?
It's great. I just got back from vacation, and I'm about to go to the Venice Film Festival, but this week is just jam-packed with stuff.
Oh, that's delicious. Thank you so much for being here. Also, Alonzo and I had a beautiful moment right when I showed up, deeply rooted in the fact that there is only so much at Rochester Big and Tall.
and we have to call each other to make sure that we're not wearing it at the same time.
Exactly. And also here, 8th Beatle. Sorry, it just it adds up over time.
I was going to say, how about this? I'll just be the first member of Oasis. I'll be the Liam or Noel. I don't remember which is the good
first
one.
Member of Oasis of Pop Rocket, Mr. Andrew T.
What's up? How's it going?
We're doing all right. How are things over at Yosis Racist?
Let me see. Still racist, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This week's on the show, we've decided to do a briefer than normal episode and talk about Crazy Rich Asians, the movie, which we finally got the chance to see. But let's kick things off by finding out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Andrew T.
Oh my gosh. Well, I had two things. So the quick one is I have been watching the third season of The Expanse, which I think has already finished and played out. It is a... I guess the quickest way to describe it is if Sci-Fi Channel made Space Game of Thrones for the budget of like half of one episode of Game of Thrones. It is.
It's a lot of paper mache.
It's a lot of. I mean, it looks like a Wing Commander loading screen. But it is. It has good writing, good if extremely uneven acting. Basically, I felt like they couldn't afford to pay any actors enough to have them accept direction.
I love when you're clearly getting Toronto's middleist.
Yeah.
You know, when you're getting the people in Vancouver who cannot book, a procedural.
Yeah. It feels like a little European also. I think they may have trucked in some South Africans. It's like a whole gamut.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Anyway, it's based on a series of books, which I have read, and I forgot. It's the Expanse Season 3 is currently going over a portion of the books that is most of the important shit happens in internal monologue, and it is not working.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm all about. Also, since we're not doing jams, sorry, that's a spoiler.
Spoiler.
I had come prepared with one, which was tagging on Karen Jam from last week. And relevant to the movie, Wong Fei's cover of Dreams by the Cranberries, which is, I think it's at the end of Chungking Express or the middle of Chungking Express.
That sounds right, yeah.
Something like that. Anyway.
Which she stars in also.
Mm-hmm. Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very weird. I was a little, jokingly talking trash about all the Chinese language covers of Western pop hits in Crazy Rich Asians, and then I realized, right, I love this version, so I'm just old.
Alonzo, before I let you all about, I have to ask you, when you want to go for 1980s sci-fi on a budget, what to you is just the most comfort food of tacky, relatively bad sci-fi?
Probably Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, just because it's got my lady Molly Ringwald in it.
Okay, great. Are you all about something this week? Is that possible, Alonso?
I am all about so many things. I almost had an all about regarding Smashing Time, the very silly late 60s musical with Lynn Redgrave and Rita Tushingham about two girls from the sticks who move to London and have a smashing time, which is now on Blu-ray. But what I really wanted to support is Support the Girls, which is Andrew Bujalski's new film that is opening at least limited this week. Stars the great Regina Hall, who does not get to lead, does not get to be first on the call sheet often enough.
Mm-hmm.
She stars as a woman who manages a Hooters-like establishment in Houston. And it's mostly just sort of one day at the gig and her sort of trying to tend to her waitresses and making sure that things are moving copacetically despite all the sort of insanity swirling around her between her home life and the guy who runs the place and the awful people who most of the customers who are awful people, except for Leah Delaria, who, of course, is the super butch lesbian who also loves beers and waitresses in short shorts and chicken wings. Exactly, while watching the fight. It is a great, great, great Regina Hall performance, and I adore her. And the movie uses a Hooters-type establishment as a sort of great microcosm of a man's world.
Oh.
You know, and so just the idea of what a woman has to do to keep her sanity and her dignity in a joint like that very much mirrors, you know, the world we live in.
Nice. That good things.
Did you guys hear that Hooters is going out of business because millennials either aren't into boobs or not sexist enough?
Yes.
It's actually because they're not into carbs and they don't want beer anymore.
That's
like, no more beer.
We need a keto Hooters.
Yeah, keto Hooters. Hooters would make a killing.
Oh, totally.
Tongson, you about something?
And on that note, after having recommended a keto Hooters, it's very rare that I bring my other business, the business of academia, into the Pop Rocket Studios. But this week, for the better part of this week, this story has been blowing up on social media, on the front page of the New York Times. And that is the very prominent queer-identified theorist, Avital Ronell, allegedly sexually harassed a gay male graduate student. And what it did was it brought out some of the behind-the-scenes business and transactions and kind of defenses that different scholars make of one another and kind of letters of support, et cetera, that all got kind of muddled into a series of conversations that intersected with the broader cultural discourse of Me Too. As a culture, I think we need to see beyond the scandal of sexual abuse. And I think that, you know, the fact that Ronell is a feminist queer scholar has, I think, brought this story up to the surface, given that there are so many sexual abuses of power in the academy, that many horrible cis straight men have gotten away with for many years, but that it just doesn't capture the media's attention in the same way. But I also want to, you know, think that beyond the sexual abuse of power is that there are many scandalous abuses of power, period, that infiltrate our worlds, and academia is no exception. And I find that the extent to which we protect power within that institution is reprehensible, although it's in keeping with the grotesque world we live in. As scholars, especially those of us in more senior ranks with tenure who are protected, I think we all need to take a long, hard look in the mirror after this event to think about our complicity in all of this, in the kind of structures of power. Who are we defending and to what ends? These cases are gnarled, they're complex, but if we're only chiming in to try to save a superstar or tear one down and keep the status quo relatively intact, I think that what's the point, right? We need to address those systems of power that keep graduate students, junior faculty, adjunct faculty, essentially powerless and silent in our worlds.
I have two questions for you.
Sure.
First of all, You make an interesting point about self-scrutiny, but isn't it just easier to point out one person, say that they're the problem, and be very self-righteous about that?
Absolutely, and I think that that's, it's no accident that that person, especially given how much academia, universities have been under assault, particularly for their like wayward liberal sexual politics, that it happens to be a queer identified woman.
Well, that's my second question is, aren't we all in love with this story? Because mm-hmm. we sort of blame like college mm-hmm. and academia for Me Too and scrutiny of gender relations in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's Ronell is like a feminist instead of like a screwy, weird feminist who looks exactly like Rush Limbaugh's cliche of like a liberal professor. And so it's fun to be like.
Although as one person, I think, tweeted like who they said, just because she's a woman doesn't mean she's a feminist. Just because she's queer doesn't mean she's a feminist. And there are certainly aspects of the case that like indicate that. I think that yes, that's the reason the outside world is paying attention to this case. What it calls up for the rest of us is to be held accountable to and responsible for so many abuses of power that aren't sexual, as I already said, that happen because of the hierarchical nature of academia. And I want us all to be able to do better.
All right. So let's go from that very difficult, complex thing to something that's just nice. We have so few things that are just nice these days. And you guys, I've been keeping a close watch on Netflix and their small budget comedies that aren't great but satisfy my soul. And then now this week we got one that was great. And you're seeing a lot of articles that are like, hey, Crazy Rich Asians is not the only Asian American centered story you should be paying attention to. And you might be tempted to just blow past that article, but no, fucking read that article. And then watch the movie, which is called To All the Boys I Loved Before. Alonzo, have you seen it yet?
I have not, but I was told by someone on the Pop Rocket page that Christmas is involved, so I'm in.
Is there Christmas? I don't. Maybe? I don't know.
Don't tell him because he won't watch it.
No, so, I'm going to watch it.
So basically, it is a girl, Lara Jean, who has written 5 letters to the boys who have been her crushes over the course of her life. She keeps them in a small box in her closet. Her sister breaks up with her boyfriend, who's one of those crushes, goes off, and her younger sister, in a very younger sister act of defiance, takes those letters, not knowing what they are, and mails them. And then, trying to manage this current crush that she has on her sister's immediate ex-boyfriend, she goes into pretending to be in a relationship with one of those previous crushes. And it's so good. Like, it is so lovely. It has a softness of tone that you have not seen since 16 Candles. Like, it very much shares a heart with 16 Candles. They watch it. They pay attention to it. And you, like, realize how much we have a generation of people who haven't had rom-coms for themselves who have been, like, hungering for this and searching for it. But the thing that is most wonderful about it, like, it's so good. It's so charming. But the most important thing is that it lets Lara Jean's Asianness and her inability to understand herself at the center of a story be part of her story.
Oh, wow.
And not, it is not, like, I feel like the only ways that we can talk about, like, race in movies or in a rom-com is either sort of, like, very explicit issue, my mom wants this of me and I don't want that, or I am just like everybody else. And the thing is that, like, this thread is never specifically racialized. Like, the racialization is just at the top. John Corbett, who is there just to sort of, like, provide the blessing of rom-com's past. Like, John Corbett as, like, it opens up with the girl saying, I hate it when dad makes Korean food. We establish a mom who has died and a relationship to Koreanness that is, like, you know, complex. And then it just gets to be part of the texture. But it really plays out in that this girl kind of can't understand that she might win this romance in some way. She can't imagine that this boy might, who she's pretending to be in a relationship with, might love her for reasons that are so specifically Lara Jean, but also the result of her never having seen herself be at the center of a story. And the fact that it is able to have that, like, I am forgotten tone of 16 Candles, that sort of like breath of the world doesn't care about me, but like layer in this other aspect. It's so good.
Isn't there a letter, right? An epistolary aspect to this?
Yes, because like there were those five letters that went out.
Yeah.
And one of the great things is that it's based on a YA novel by an Asian American writer. And it's just the great thing of if we let different people have voices and get to write things, you get these new tones. Like, it's both celebrating a tone that we know so well and adding like more texture to it. It's really, really great.
Are there also 13 cassette tapes?
I mean, the thing is like, I do get mad at those things based on YA from being so fucking structured. But, you know, it's like Hollywood won't take a risk anymore. And the fact that there were no Avengers involved in this movie at all, I think is pretty fucking impressive. And also just like, you know, centering on an Asian American girl and never having the weight of the story hinge on her Asian Americanness or the fact that her parent, you know, like her Asian American parent who should be yelling at her to be a doctor. Like, even in The Great Double Happiness, you still have an element of that.
Totally.
And here, it's not, and it's great.
Quick question, to wrap my head around it. When she writes these letters, does she address the envelopes?
Yes.
Does that get, why would you address the envelopes?
That's a great question. It is addressed. She is basically to tell herself that it's real. And
right.
Lara Jean's relationship to herself is one of the great things about this movie, is that she really does, like, she's interesting. She takes herself seriously, but she's also not a big character. She's, like, an internal person. And the movie deals with that really nicely, mostly by having Noah Centineo, who plays the boy who she has the fake relationship with, be the most charismatic and so clearly in love with her from the first moment. It's real good.
Nice.
All right. I'm sorry for talking so much, but I need good romantic comedies in my life. Speaking of which, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about Crazy Rich Asians right after this.
I can't hear myself, but I'm assuming that...
These are real podcast listeners, not actors. Hey, thanks for coming. Here's a list of descriptors. What would you choose to describe the perfect podcast?
I mean, vulgarity.
Dumb. Definitely dumb.
And like, right here, this one, meritless.
What if I told you there was a podcast that did have all of that?
No.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. And it's free.
Jordan, Jesse, Go?
Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. A real podcast.
Beloved Maximum Fun Star Trek podcast, The Greatest Generation, is going out on tour.
We are bringing Greatest Gen Con to a bunch of cities in the U.S. and Canada. It's our big tribute to / send-up of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And we have a big leg coming up.
Yes, we are raising our legs on a number of cities in the coming weeks.
We're going to Washington, D.C. on August 23rd, the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York on August 24th, Mass Mocha in North Adams, Massachusetts on August 25th, Pittsburgh on the 28th, Boston, Massachusetts at the Wilbur Theater on the 29th, Atlanta, Georgia at the Earl on the 30th, Ferndale, Michigan at the Magic Bag on the 31st.
Those are some great big rooms and some great big cities, Ben.
And it's a really fun show. It's accessible even if you haven't listened to the podcast yet.
We can't wait to see you when we're out on tour. Check greatestgencon.com for dates and ticketing information.
And Khan is spelled K-H-A-N because Wrath of Khan, greatestgencon.com.
Support for Pop Rocket comes from Audible. Audiobooks are a great sidekick for summer activities like hiking, road tripping, and enjoying downtime outdoors and more. And Audible fans have the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, which lets you fill your summer with more stories. Let's be honest, My Life is a Goddess by Guy Branum. It does decent work there, but like, what do you guys end up listening to on Audible? I'm a huge fan of This Is How I Want to Consume a Nice Andy Cohen Book. Like, there is nothing more delightful than listening to one of the Andy Cohen diaries on Audible and just letting it, like, flow through me as I'm on, like, a car trip or just, like, on the beach.
I segued from Tina Fey's Bossy Pants to, why am I blanking now on her name? The star of Parks and Recreation.
Amy Poehler.
Amy Poehler. Doi, yes, to her book. I have my sights set on the Parker Posey, which I'm hearing great yes. things about. So I like witty women.
It's very good. Well, if you're looking for witty women's books, I can't use this as an opportunity to promote my book again. I'm sorry, Alonzo. Audible members get credit every month. Good for any audiobook in their store, regardless of price, and unused credits roll over to the next month. Didn't like your audiobook? You can exchange it, no questions asked. Karen, what's on your, like, Audible vision board?
I just plan to re-listen to the Crazy Rich Asians trilogy, all three of the books, on Audible.
Yeah, just let it wash over you. Let all of those designer names just fill up your ears while you're... I don't know how you cardio, Karen.
While I'm on the open stride machine.
Start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is absolutely free. Go to audible.com/rocket or text rocket to 500-500 to get started. Welcome back to Pop Rock. I'm your host, Guy Brennan. With me in studio are...
Karen Tongson.
Alonzo Duraldi.
Andrew T.
And last week we talked about Kevin Kwan's book, Crazy Rich Asians, and then we got to see the movie. So now we are going to talk about the movie. Karen Tongson, we know what you thought of the book. What did you think of the movie?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I actually saw it the first opportunity I had at the 11 a.m. screening at Arclight Hollywood's Cinerama Dome. I dragged a friend to come see it with me on a Wednesday at 11 a.m., tempting her with the food we would eat afterwards. And, you know, I have to say that I was actually kind of stunned by how, you know, when they get to Singapore and they're going through the hawker markets, that almost made me cry. It was so, you know, I was just like, whoa. I mean, I know that it was like a kind of sensationalized travel scene, and it's like, it might as well be on the Travel Channel. But just seeing these young Asian people having a good time, like, and being on this giant Cinerama Dome screen, it really touched me to see that happening. And even though I didn't necessarily identify with any one of them individually, it still felt remarkable.
Well, the books are so luscious, and I feel like for the movie in so many ways, like, satisfied that, but that scene particularly does feel the most, well, it reaches the height of, like, food porn that the book manages to get throughout, but it just feels, like, decadent and friendly in a way that I think the rest of the movie is, like, trying to reach for.
Yeah. It's like young, hot Asian people sweating and eating food.
Yes.
I could have used a little more chili crab, personally. Just a little bit.
Not too much satay.
Yeah, really.
So when I went to the theater, it was in the same way that, like, when I went to Black Panther opening weekend, like, there were a lot of African Americans dressed to the nines who were excited to be getting to watch a movie that was for them. And going, like, to see Crazy Rich Asians at a theater where half of the theaters were showing Crazy Rich Asians, it was exciting to see, like, so much, like, Asian 20-somethings, like, out to see a movie that understands that they are, like, characters in their own lives. Did you guys notice that?
I saw a press screening thing that they
were... We get it, you're an insider.
No, but they were clearly trying to influence us because it was, like... A couple, like, you know, I was a plus one of, like, a writer, a movie reviewer, but then there were clearly, like, 90% of the audience was, like, rabid screening fans who'd somehow already seen it multiple times, even though it was, like, 2 weeks before it was supposed to come out. So the energy was bonkers in there. It really was amazing.
Have either of you read the book?
No.
I have not. I now want to tackle the trilogy.
So did it feel like a movie to you?
Oh God, yes. No. I found I was so satisfied. I mean, from the opening moments where you get that kind of big bandy ta-pa-ta-ta sound, I was like, okay. And the whole time I just felt like this is a great old school studio movie.
Yeah.
You know, and it's four quadrant, It's got zip to it. There's laughs and there's tears and there's, you know, great clothes and there's food, you know, and just all this stuff. And I just thought it was, I had a blast from start to finish. I just thought it was just such a wonderful bauble. And it made me think about my own sort of journey of getting to see me on a screen. Mm-hmm. You know, those sort of early new queer cinema films, which were like badly lit and grim, but, you know, they were queer, damn it. And then a couple years later, we finally got something that was at least sort of sitcom-y, you know. And so as big a deal as Love, Simon was in that regard of just getting that, you know, what you were saying before, that 16 Candles ending you didn't know you needed, you know. I think I don't want to speak for Asian audiences, but I can imagine going from either being sort of like invisible or, you know, embarrassing stock characters to, you know, the occasional cool indie film or whatever, but to then get to see this like beautifully lit and costumed and literally choreographed movie, you know, I just would have been like, just yes, all the ice cream.
It was interesting the way that the movie did sort of like rest an elbow on Awkwafina and Nico Santos as Peakley and Oliver, because like the gorgeous, glorious, beautiful people who were doing like so much of what the book mattered, like so much of that was internal. Like Gemma Chan, who plays Astrid, like I never felt like I had a relationship with her in the way that like in the book you like fucking fall in love with Astrid. But I also thought Constance Wu did a lot. Like there's a moment where she and Nick are like on a bench talking to each other, and like you got the Constance Wu magic of like, even if they haven't written jokes for her, Constance Wu is still taking the energy of this scene and making it something I'm laughing at. And I thought she did a lot to like remind us this is a comedy and Rachel Chu is a character.
Well, I think a lot of our Pop Rocket listeners actually, in response to the book club episode, said, well, you know, Rachel, we found Rachel boring, or like Rachel and Nick were boring in general. And, you know,
it was books, you mean?
In the books. Right. Yeah, it was really frustrating to encounter that character. But seeing Constance Wu animate Rachel in the film actually made Rachel a much more interesting character.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the transformations from book to screen, where people ask, like, why doesn't she have a spine? Well, Constance Wu definitely brings a spine to Rachel on the screen.
I think the one thing that stood out to me is it does feel like there is an extra quarter of an act between acts two and three, where I'm just like, I know this is driven by the narrative of the book, but let's just wrap this shit up, guys.
Well, the thing that was interesting for me was clearly they went into this book that is luscious, but maybe not a story, and definitely a very passive story for Rachel. And it gave us the poker scene at the beginning and the mahjong scene at the end. And as somebody who was seeing it through the lens of the book, it didn't feel the most organic. It didn't feel the most motivated. I kind of wanted, if you were going to make her an expert on game theory, I maybe wanted her to play some games before the success of the mahjong scene.
Well, it takes, you know, Awkwafina reminding her that she's in the middle of one to make her realize, oh, yes, I have to strategize now. And it's like, you should know this, professor.
Yeah.
I would imagine, right, the problem with that is that feeds too much into the conniving gold digging narrative. If she just came in and outplayed everyone, she needs to be outplayed for the romantic comedy to work.
There need to be moments of being outmaneuvered, I think. Yeah. Like, and I mean, especially because the character starts off thinking that, you know, parents love me. I give good parent, in the words of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And, you know, and she has to kind of readjust, especially as these other ugly kind of scenes transpire when she's getting picked on by all the Singaporean society girls.
She's playing, I mean, it's a character we know in terms of the, you know, the plucky, you know, farmer's, not farmer's daughter necessarily, but you know, middle class girl who, you know, gets anointed somehow and enters, you know, the magic realm of the rich people. And, you know, they're all mean to her and they all try to shun her. But, you know, her implicit goodness or wit or style or something gets her over, you know.
One of the things that I thought was really fun were, like, to me, the two places where they dipped into our last major studio Asian American centered film, The Joy Luck Club. One is casting Lisa Liu as Ama, but the other was sort of like the conversation between Rachel and her mom at the beginning of like, you like your brain and your mouth is American. And mm-hmm. like that idea from the Joy Luck Club of like they saw the world with, you know, throats that only swallowed Coca-Cola and eyes that saw the world like an American. And it was nice having those moments of Rachel sort of realize like, oh, a game is being played here that I'm not seeing the way that everybody else is.
I do think the movie tries to have it a little bit both ways in the new world, old world split. Because essentially it's a clash of cultures, but it really takes pains to make it kind of like both are good in their own way. As opposed to, it feels like that there could, should, ought to be a more stronger point of view on like one is better than the other.
Well,
I don't know.
Okay. And here is a spoiler alert if you haven't read the books. But one of the things I thought was amazing about the books is like Eleanor and Amma don't come around in the books. Like in the books, like Nick has to make the call, and I worried that they were a little bit eating their seed corn by like having Eleanor like give the ring to Nick. But also, I really appreciated that the screenwriter, whoever it was, went in there and was like, let's make a rom-com. Like, let's put in this Mahjong scene. Let's go to a fucking airport because that is where declarations of love happen.
But I did like
it was Adele Lim and some white guy.
I did like the fact, though, that Eleanor, she may have given her the ring, but when you see her at the party, she is not, it's not like they get a big hug at the end.
Yeah.
Like, there's clearly, like, you know, you've won this round, outsider, but, you know, I'll be back in the second movie and look out, you know.
And the Mahjong scene, like, I was angry at myself for not understanding Mahjong enough to be able to track what was going on, but I loved that I was able to follow along as a Mahjong illiterate person and sort of understand the idea of she's giving up something so that Eleanor will win, so she will see that the choice was hers.
If I may specifically on this, I think you had the better experience because the worst version of that is the version that I have, which is I know just enough about Mahjong to think I can follow along, but I did not. And I misinterpreted almost everything because I was like, I think I get what's happening here.
I think the whole conflict, though, about, you know, immigrants versus the ones who never left the home country. That is, I think, part of what makes the movie so kind of universally appealing, because I certainly could relate to it as somebody whose parents were born in Spain. Whenever I go to Spain, I love it and I butcher the language. And, you know, I'm very, as much as I feel like, oh, it's, you know, the homeland, at the same time, I'm always aware of like, I'm the American and I don't live here and I didn't grow up here and my point of view is going to be different on this stuff. And I see this movie maybe having like a My Big Fat Greek Wedding type of appeal in that it's so specific that everybody can read their own whatever national, ethnic, whatever history into it.
Although though, even beyond that, I mean, you know, Rachel is not Singaporean, right? And Singaporean is something different and special and really separate. Maybe not so much special, but certainly separate from being from
special to them,
exactly. From being mainland Chinese or having mainland Chinese background,
or an ABC
or an ABC background. Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the questions that you know, people have been asking certainly is whether or not, like, you know, we can talk about this as like, can you think of this as an Asian American film? And I don't think, you know, and I think that, to a certain extent, yes, because you have Rachel as an Asian American whose perspective we get throughout. But it really kind of departs from the usual tropes of Asian Americanness.
Yeah.
Well, know? But part of that is, I feel like, because it also uses this. The my least favorite part about the film is how it kind of tries to ignore the class stuff by wrapping it in culture and family rather than pure insanity. Because the thing is, like, this movie would be crazy if she, like, the situation would be crazy if she were a poor Singaporean. It would never happen. Or if they were merely rich Americans.
Or if she was Filipino American.
Well, I mean, God forbid.
Yeah.
I mean, there has been some criticism about, like, it being such a rarefied, look how much money we have, look how much money we have story. I fucking love those stories. Like, I simultaneously am like, everyone, we've been forcing everyone to read stories about landed British people for so long. Don't other landed people get to tell their landed stories? But then also, just like, it's a rom-com. Like, how rarefied the world of like accessible New York or San Francisco set rom-coms is ridiculous. And also just having that tone of like, Singapore, we're doing fine. You know, like it felt like empowering.
Well, and I think, you know, the movie is so loved to tell those big glitzy stories. I think then it becomes a thing of like, well, you're not going to stop making them anytime soon. So let's all get our dibs on one.
Well, and also there are things like, Peak Lee and
or Peak Lin.
Peak Lin, I'm sorry, and Oliver as entrance points that like the first book never says that Oliver is poorer than the rest of them, and like Peak Lin's status as sort of like aspiring scraping person who understands the world enough but is also not part of it. It was really fun to have those people be engaging with that world. Though I have to say, my favorite moment is Peak Lin specifically declining twice when offered, can I go to the party? And then being like, fuck yeah, I'll go to that party. It was, you know, it felt very Chinese, but also very much of the world I live in, you know?
And she, you know, and the thing about that, well, she's new money, right? That's the distinction too, right? So it's sort of, they're new money. They have like the kind of, that Baroque, like, you know, Trumpian furniture in their house. and they are, they have the tie to America, which is the kind of source of crassness and everything like that, right? And, you know, that's the kind of shift that they made also in the father's character, mm-hmm. right? Is that they accommodated Ken Leong.
Yeah.
Ken Leong by...
Ken Jeong.
Ken Jeong.
Ken Jeong. They accommodated Ken Jeong and perhaps and also people's desires maybe not to affect Asian-y accents if they didn't really have them by making him somebody who studied in the States, even though I don't think his character in the book did that, right?
One move in the movie that I found fascinating was just making the dad not be a character. Just sort of saying, like, these are politics that are going on.
Nick's dad
was saying, like, this is politics that's just going on between the women. Just let them do it.
Yeah, let's cut the dad out. Yeah.
What's he a bigger? Is he a bigger character in the book or a character
he's
at all
just
in the book?
There. Like, he is defined by absence, but his absence is sort of seen as, like, what can happen with this rich guy who just doesn't want to engage with, you know, the world of Singapore. It's like a lot is there for somebody who wants to do what Amma wants them to do. Mm-hmm. And he's somebody who has failed at
that. The source of their money is much more mysterious in the book. It's not that they have like this multinational corporation and dad's taking care of business. It's just sort of like, oh, we don't know. They're old money. We have no idea where they have all of these assets
from. I will just say that's one of those things where I was like, I mean, I think the less you get into rich people in Asia, the better, because there's definitely bones in the foundation to that compound.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing actually, though, about Peak Lin's family being like considered crass because of their you know gravitation towards America and Western stuff, there is the thing though of like, you know, rich Asians are obsessed with the West, and you see it in this, in the cars, in the fashion brands, and even
reading The Little Prince in French.
Oh my God. Yeah.
But there's even and then the nod to, which I know it's on the list, but I'll just jump in, of like the Chinese language covers of Western pop songs, which again was part of the my all about also. But that was a thing where I'm like, why are we so fucking obsessed with like Western culture with that shit? I know a lot of people, a lot of Asian folks found it very empowering, but every time I heard one of those, I was just like, oh, come on.
Well, I mean, I feel like every studio executive just wants to hold on to a person from Peoria and say, are you doing okay?
Yeah.
Are you getting through this? And it's been lovely seeing the stats where, you know, the movie is doing great. And I think 60 to 70% of the viewing audience is not white. And it's sort of challenging us to realize, like, hey, there's a possibility.
Look who buys tickets.
Yeah.
I am old enough to remember when The Lover came out in the early 90s, based on the Margarita Duras novel. And at the time, the sort of ridiculous coverage of, look, a sexy Asian man.
Yeah.
Like, such a thing had never been thought of before, you know? And so I do love that. One of the things I love about this movie, and particularly the fact that it's being aimed at square at a white American audience, in addition to other folks, is that there is some, like, Asian man candy.
There's, yeah.
You know, because.
Serious abs.
Yes.
Real
beef.
This is a real issue, okay? I went into this movie and I was like, Colin Coo is not hot enough because I needed a lot of hotness from Colin Coo. And then I was like, why wasn't Harry Shum Colin Coo? And then I had to accept that, like, in the long run, setting Harry Shum up in just one post-credit scene as Charlie Wu is fundamentally more important because he is equal level of hotness with Gemma Chan?
Yep.
Yeah.
And I want to see those movies. And the guy who played Colin Coo did have a nice, like, surfery vibe. But...
Oh, Chris Pang.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I went to Berkeley. I have a refined taste when it comes to tall, fratty Asian guys. Okay, I've got a certain level of need.
The guy who plays the cheating husband.
Also
no slouch.
Michael Tao. Okay,
Michael
so
Tao.
My question for you guys is: did you connect to that Astrid and Michael story? Because in the book, it does a really nice job of saying, like, here are the dangers of what could come from Rachel and Nick, and it just felt very slight.
As in she married essentially a commoner, and look where that tension brought.
Mm-hmm.
I see. I that did not read as a primary thing for me in the movie. Although I will say, I think I know a lot. I think there was an article about it I don't know if it was specifically about Asian American men crying during Crazy Rich Asians, but anyway, there was like an article about that. I didn't read the whole thing.
I think
it
just kind of just appeared in my feed right before I came.
Yeah, yeah. But I actually found the scene with Astrid and Rachel connecting after the sort of fish debacle on the beach very, like, that was the moment that got me, and I don't think that was for everyone.
But that's interesting. Why?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it was just because of the sadness and vulnerability of having been cheated on.
Yeah.
That moment was really nice to me.
I got a little misty in the Eleanor helps Nick change shirts scene.
Yes.
Can I just say...
Is misty the word?
What
no,
the hell kind of sexual tension was that? Oh, my God.
No, I'm a sucker for movies about mothers and adult sons because I lost mine at an early age.
Oh.
And Michelle Yeoh was really communicating that, in a really powerful
got
way.
It.
Yeah. Yes. Also, Michelle Yeoh gets to have sex with sexual tension with everyone.
Yes.
She's Michelle Yeoh. It's her job.
I think I wrote this in the doc, but I was counting down the Henry Golding sexual tension. Michelle Yeoh, I think, with Chris Pang, and then Gemma Chan.
Oh, yeah. When the two of them are floating in the lagoon together.
Oh, yeah.
We want to see that movie.
Yeah. This is a Falcon video waiting to happen.
Oh, truly. I was just like, just have them be in love. That's it's a more interesting movie. Have them be in love.
Or at least like a boarding school flashback, and they just hold hands for a second.
Yeah.
Anything.
About the Nick putting on a fresh shirt, like, the extent to which Nick Young's laundry is a character in the trilogy cannot be emphasized enough. Andrew, I hear that you have an alt pitch for the movie.
Oh, man. Because as someone who I think has been putting in a lot of time on Twitter arguing that this movie needs more class warfare, I want the turn after the fish scene to just become Rachel Chu's Rambo First Blood on the compound, where she takes revenge on the rich assholes who did this to her.
On Bachelorette Island.
Yeah, that's all I want.
So what is the experience of having to rest so much sort of like cultural need on this one specific movie that has decided to tell a story about, like, you know, specific people, like... disgustingly rich Singaporean Chinese, and the fact that, like, there is a little bit of a sense of, like, well, this is the movie you get until 4 years from now when they realize, like, that this made money, so they make another one.
Who wrote the article that didn't reflect the entire Asian experience or something?
Washington Post. Yeah.
And Justin Chang had a great comeback where it was like, Tokyo Story doesn't reflect the entire Asian experience. And, you know, like, listed out all these sort of Asian classic films from over the years. Because, like, yeah, if the fact that Hollywood decides to make one Asian Asian film every 25 years doesn't mean that automatically that movie must carry the burden of all Asianness globally for a quarter century.
It needs to carry the burden, but it shouldn't have to, I would argue.
No, it shouldn't have to.
This is like arguing that like Sex and the City 2 doesn't encapsulate the white experience. Like, what are you talking
about?
I really think it does.
I have rubbed yams against my genitals repeatedly, and I would say it is universal of our people.
If anybody had eaten any of the macaron, then I'd say yes, it was more reflective of my own life, but they let them sit there.
Honestly, like, I missed it up more at that, like, hawker, like, the food scene, more than anything else, because I just felt like it was where that movie got to stretch out and be like, this is our world.
Well, it reaches beyond the courtship narrative that is about, like, class and opulence, and that is that classic Hollywood studio structure, right? And just lets them run loose.
So, like, whose movie?
Asian joy. Hashtag Asian joy.
And also having them be normal.
What about
first?
Asian luck?
But, like that I think is why that scene is so affecting, because it's like, you know, a big trend on Twitter has been like, you know, Asian people, on Asian Twitter, like, finally a movie that I can see myself in it. And part of me is like, okay, I could see myself in like the first 3 minutes of that movie, maybe. But like, so I mean, I think that those moments, and actually the moment on the raft, where they're a little bit away from the opulence, I like that a lot more personally.
I mean, like, the books do a really nice job of layering in the notion that, like, these people coming from, like, a deeply colonized, violently colonized, not-so-distant past, that money is the thing that protects them. And, like, having a stronger sense of that is nice, but also it's a movie, and you just want people dressed up like they're from the 20s and dancing around.
But I think also, you know, I think as an audience member, you're like, okay, all these houses and these estates and these cars, whatever, are great, but quite probably never going to be part of my life. But the idea of being somebody who knows how to go to a food market and knows exactly where to go and what to order, that's a skill that you could actually have. Yeah. And it's one that shows that you are, like, cool and in tune with the place where you are, and, you know, like, that you have taste, like, literal taste, not just knowing what furniture to pick. Yeah.
Also, seeing a cold beer in a glass made me think how nice it would be to have a cold beer in a glass.
One quick other thing, though, too, is I think the hardest criticism I have for this movie is the thing you were talking about how your wealth protects you, but East Asian people, Chinese people, especially in Singapore, really do forget that lesson. And you see it in illustrated in maybe the worst way possible in the very brief scene where the girls are surprised by the guards. Really the only dark-skinned people that have any, like, you know, import at all, or not import at all, but, you know, any
appearance.
Impact on, yeah, really, except besides an extra. And that's the thing that I'm personally really struggling with, because I obviously want to very much be wholeheartedly, unreservedly behind this Asian expression of joy. But this movie, really, the only time it talks about brown Asians is to shit on them. And so that really, really bummed me out. And I don't know. I think it's a thing that East Asian people, and again, Chinese people and rich Chinese people, don't talk about enough.
I mean, in the books, the cousin who has done the unforgivable thing is marrying a Malay woman.
Yeah.
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 And I think that, like, call it colorism, racism, bigotry, like, I know it has no place in this movie, but it is I was a little upset that it's basically played for an exacerbated laugh in that one scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it does have some place in some of the books, but what it does, I think, more than anything, is it kind of documents that inequality, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, Southeast Asians, like, don't exist in this orbit or in this sphere, and we only see them in the service classes. We see how they're, like, incorporated into this totally colonial structure that the Youngs live in, right?
Like they've just replaced the whites at the top of the... They haven't made things equal for everyone.
What were the performances that you were most excited about? Who do you think is going to be able to walk away from this movie and be able to leverage it into greater success here in Los Angeles? I will begin by saying Ms. Awkwafina
Hell yeah.
has proven herself two times in a summer, and mm-hmm. she gets to do some things. Like, you know, it isn't Tiffany Haddish in Girls Trip, but I think it's starting to add up to something like that, and I would like to see, you know, Awkwafina get more opportunities. I also think, you know, it's like we've got a perfectly good Constance Wu, mm-hmm. and even though she's only like 32 or 33, we've been treating her like a mom because of the show Fresh Off the Boat. And I think she will get, I hope, more opportunities off of this.
Is Nico Santos, is he a stand-up? Is he an actor? What's his
story? He's in Superstore. Yeah.
He was the
one of my favorite network sitcoms.
He was the alpha gay comic in San Francisco immediately after me. So yeah, and I mean the fact that they like doing the work of getting an actual factual Asian American gay guy to play Oliver Tien, like that was the other thing that was like truly transcendent to me was
absolutely
not just watching my friend, but watching my faggoty friend get to be faggoty on screen was exciting.
And watching a Filipino actor break out.
Yeah,
really. I mean, mm-hmm. there's your brown like representation.
True.
He's you know,
but he's playing a Chinese.
I know he's playing. Yeah. That's the thing. There are the separation between the production and then
sure,
what is being represented is I think that where like people are having kind of cross conversations about these things, because as a production, it's you know different people from different kind of Asian and even Southeast Asian backgrounds playing these roles, but they're all still playing East Asians who are really mm-hmm. rich. But I do think that Nico's going to get like a bump after this film. I think that, you know, especially with his work in Superstore, especially in this, I think that he's going to have some other opportunities to be in bigger comedies.
Will he still respond to my texts? Who can say?
Will he still consider doing pop rock?
Yes.
I know. Yeah.
I will say, I mean, I think John Chu, the director, really uh-huh. came through. I suppose I got to give a shout out to my boy Jimmy O Yang, who just has a very brief part as the loudish asshole Bernard Tai.
But it's also the wonderful thing of like, if they make a sequel, Bernard Tai is going to get to do a lot of stuff.
He's got a lot going on in the sequels.
I think, those are my... Oh, and Henry Golding, of course.
I was going to say, totally Henry Golding.
To me, the real breakout.
Well, one of the interesting dynamics is, like, so much in Los Angeles, if you are a person of color, in TV and in film, you get to play the goofy friend. And there was a scandal on Deadline a couple of years ago where it was like white character actors aren't even getting to read for anything because all of the goofy characters are being played, they're casting people of color. And it was nice just having like, you know, hot people of color with nice British accents like get to do something so that, you know, it creates more opportunities for fat white people like myself to come and play their goofy friends.
Well, we used to only have Daniel Day Kim's abs. And now there's just like a whole like Whitman sampler of Asian abs out there.
I want to see some Henry Golding, like whatever his 007 is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, same for Gemma Chan. I mean, like...
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
She's like... I don't even know what the metaphor is, but in this movie, she's just...
like, diaphanous.
Yes, that's as good as that. Like she is Hedy Lamarr. Like she's that kind of old school movie actress where you can't believe they're even human.
Well, it's why I liked the beach scene was because it was the one time where you got the real Astrid feel of like this is a person who's down to earth. Mm. And Gemma Chan was pulling it off, and I just wish that there was a little more bandwidth for her to be like,
oh, yeah,
a person and not just perfection.
I'm not saying this is a bad thing or as a critique, but I just she's just so stunning. And and just glides through this film like she's aloft.
Also, Harry Shum Jr. is a huge winner because like he got like pretty top billing for like 3 seconds.
I forgot who it was on Twitter, but it was like the real winner is Harry Shum Jr.'s agent.
It's just so true. But it's also like what a great agreement that like if this is a success, he's essentially male lead of movie number two.
Yeah.
Well, it's like when Julie Walters shows up at the beginning of the first Harry Potter movie for 30 seconds. You're like, well, we'll see you again.
I do like how confidently they were like, yeah, we're building out this extended universe. It was like Marvel-esque and like, yeah, this is how we're doing it.
Alonzo, would you like to leave your career behind and just start a nonprofit where we get more work for Julie Walters?
Oh, God. Can we write up some grants for that?
Absolutely. All right. If you want more Crazy Rich Asians discussion, please make sure to check out this week's Who Shot Ya?
Yes.
Alonzo, I'm not familiar with this podcast. Who's on it?
Me. I hate the word myself. I'm on with, usually it is April Wolf and our wonderful host, Ricky Carmona. This week, it's Ricky and me and the very funny Jenny Yang. And we have lots to say about this movie. So if you have not yet begun to scratch your Crazy Rich Asians punditry itch, head over to Who Shot Ya.
Also, you should just be following Jenny Yang on social media because nobody shits on a white chef who thinks he invented Asian food like Jenny Yang. I'm sorry, Karen.
I mean, I love that how to eat a peanut butter sandwich video, peanut butter jelly sandwich video.
All right. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brand, with Karen Thompson and our good friends Alonzo Duralde, who you should listen to on Who Shot Ya. And where can people follow you?
I'm at A Duralde on Twitter. You can read me at The Wrap. And I also co-host the Linoleum Knife podcast with my husband, Dave White.
How is Dave?
He's great.
What does it sound like when he gets laryngitis?
You know, actually, he goes from basso profundo to near silence.
It's just like subsonic at that point.
Yeah, the dogs in the neighborhood would go crazy.
Dolphins are uncomfortable. Andrew, where can people follow you?
Please listen to Yo, Is This Racist? And if you are in London on the September 16th, I will not be there, but my co-host will be doing a live Yo, Is This Racist? Podcast. And then if you're in Chicago in the end of November, I will be there. So please buy some tickets.
You've gone international?
What?
It was literally by happenstance.
It's very exciting.
Thank you.
You guys, the VMAs were this week, which marks the official musical end of summer, which means our summer jam episode is nigh. This week, we did not have jams so that we could cleanse the palate in preparation. Karen, what's your gut telling you? What do you think is in the lead?
As my dear friend JJ said to me this weekend, it's between Drake or Cardi B.
Alonzo, do you have any picks?
Let's not rule out Janet Jackson and Daddy Yankee as a last-minute winner.
Okay. All right. A lot of dogs in this fight, you guys. Get on the Facebook group. Tell us what you think. And we'll be coming to you in 2 weeks with our official Summer Jams episode. Our theme music is Parting Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone who gave us 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week, we'd like to thank Margaret Needs Her Iron. I've been listening from the beginning, but I was too lazy to leave a review. I look forward to the show every week, and I hope it goes on forever. They have always proven their ability to adapt to scheduling and host availability. This week, more relevant than ever. But it somehow feels like the same show. It's The View of Podcasts minus Meghan McCain. I will always be the Debbie Mountainopoulos. TKPK Resident said, I am way late to this podcast, but that just means I have a great back catalog for me to work my way through. I started listening because I'm a fan of Guy from other projects. It's lovely. I'm very proud of my work on other projects. But I love all the panelists and actually most look forward every week to Karen's jams. Thank you. Me too. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. Plus, we've got that amazing Instagram account.
At Pop Rocket Podcast.
We are a production of MaximumFun.org. Our show is edited by Shayna Deloria, whom I have not met. And our senior producer is Laura Swisher, who's one of my oldest friends.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.